Okay, friends, we're going to begin our work again. The group here is gathering, and we have out there in the world 9 attendees, so and Brett watching over, so welcome Andrew and Daniel and Elena, Johanna, you're there, Leslie, Alin, Mauricio, Nicholas, and Nia. Hi, Nia. Nice to see you. We are working on the fifth sentence, really a sixth sentence. Together, let the band of brothers onward move, out of the fire, into the cold, and towards a newer tension. All right, we good? Welcome back from breakfast and from a beautiful day out there that one wonders why one is in a classroom. But okay, that reminds me of the law of repulse for the fifth ray. It was something like, deep in a pyramid on all sides built around by stone, in the deep dark of that stupendous place, a mind and brain embodied in a man were working. And then it said, outside the pyramid, the world of God established itself. The sky was blue, the wind blew, the sky was blue, the wind blew free, the trees and flowers opened themselves unto the sun. But in the pyramid, down in its dim laboratory, a worker stood toiling at work. So here you are. We can identify with that state. We're in this nice room, but the drapes are closed purposefully. And we can get on with the business. Together, let the band of brothers onward move, out of the fire, into the cold, and towards a newer tension. So we will be able to complete this morning, I'm quite sure. And then we'll work on the second initiation this afternoon. Here in brief form, certain basic instructions are given. Each of them indicates the new attitudes imposed upon all who have taken initiation. Notice the word there. It's not the new attitudes developed by all. The first ray quality of imposition is present. So the will is operating. And when we venture into this area of expanding consciousness and power, the higher forces impose upon their instrument certain approaches and attitudes. These instructions, he says, they cannot be interpreted in terms of the path of discipleship or probation. Now, technically considered, the path of discipleship, as far as the human being is concerned, is ending at the third initiation. There, at that point, D.K. begins to call the individual the initiate disciple, or the disciple initiate. And of course, we are all disciples, and even the great ones are disciples of some greater entity. But confining this to the consideration of how the path is usually trodden and the usual human approach, he's telling us that the path of probation, the perspective of the path of probation or the path of discipleship leading to the third degree, is not illuminating or appropriate for these particular instructions, which begin once the third degree has been taken. Behind the group there stands the door. The ordinary and easily arrived at significances mean little to the initiate mind. Sometimes when he's talking about the initiate, he talks about the initiate consciousness or the initiate mind. Not like the individual is the initiate, but that they possess certain faculties which initiate entrance into a deeper and wider phase of life experience. So the quality of mind that they have and the quality of consciousness that they have, is that is what distinguishes them as an initiate. And of course also the degree of empowerment of their energy system, which also opens certain doors. Let me briefly consider them so that clarity of thought, though not of detail, may prevail. In so many of DK's works, he's just saying, look, I'm giving you the outline. He even basically said that about A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. This is written in outline form, and I'm writing, giving only the briefest indications. That's his implication. And yet for us, it's a 1,200-page book that takes years and years to make our way through, and then we have to start again. So let me bring some clarity of concept, he says. So out of the fire. This is a symbolic way of indicating that the personality life is definitely and finally left behind. What is then the nature of the fire that we are leaving behind? What type of fire? As there are three types. Yeah, that's it. Fire by friction. We are leaving fire by friction behind. It's a world of disunity with many different forms and qualities. Most of them perceived as in friction with each other, in contention, in conflict. It's only as the soul begins to influence the personality consciousness that we begin to perceive the unity behind the apparent friction. So we are living in the midst of commotion, of becoming, of all kinds of mobility, which is unsettled and usually often in a state of conflict. So the world is burning, you know, and I'm recalling now something that Shankara said, or at least an image that I remember. The world of samsara is burning. It's on fire. And samsara is all the type of passing experience we have that the senses reveal, the lower worlds reveal. It's like a great fire. And it's a fire that's out of control, and it hasn't been quieted down by the realization of the fire of unity, the realization of solar fire. We're all somehow in the midst of action and reaction, or what the Tibetans called the actions and reactions, time and space, which have to be again quieted down by the sense of being. So we have a forest fire going, and we are so much in the midst of it that perhaps we do not realize how frictional it really is when compared with the states of understanding that the soul reveals. So this is a symbolic way of indicating that the personality life is definitely and finally left behind. The fourth rule in this series, let the group see that all the 18 fires die down and that the lesser lives return unto the reservoir of life. So even there, every one of the 49 fires, or the subplanes, are referred to as fires. And the ones that are under the control of the moon, and probably we would say under the control of Mars, because if we really, you know, if we look at that closely, I'll show you what I mean here, as soon as I can get out my, okay, I should have had this ready, but in the Cosmic Fire book, see, what was it that I was going to show you? It's just our map. Just our map, that all of these lower subplanes are considered some of the 49 fires. And they are in the sublunar worlds, and they are the elemental fires, and these are the ones that are really burning strenuously, strongly, in the life of the average person. And until those fires somewhat die down, we cannot see clearly. So the table of creative hierarchy shows this. This is the table that shows us the rulers of the different hierarchies, or these groups of monads that are found on the different planes, and together some of them create that being we call man. You know, man is a composite of a number of these creative hierarchies. And just take a look at the hierarchy of the lunar lords. First of all, they're called lunar, so we know they stem from an earlier chain relating to the moon chain, and then they are ruled by the planet Mars, the red planet, the planet of passion, desire, instinct, driving, blind force. So it's the Mars vibration plus that of the moon for these lower 18 subplanes, which has to die down. Let the group see that all the 18 fires die down, and then we can begin to talk about the soul, and then we can begin to talk about the will, and not until. So, this raging elemental Martian lunar fire, which is so engrossing for so many years, so many millions of years, and has us absolutely attached to its lower phenomenon, is finally left behind, out of the fire. Of course, right there, you find yourself, in a way, as far as your goals and objectives are concerned, separating yourself from humanity. You're really entering the fifth kingdom, and where humanity is at the moment is still in the midst of the raging fire. That's where their consciousness is. And you are trying to achieve a higher perspective, which allows you to be of some use when you go back into the fire, just the way the Christ did, to help out. It is this phrase which gives the clue to the initiation which is referred to in this rule. Now, does that mean anything to us? It is this phrase which gives us the clue to the initiation referred to in this rule. I mean, right now he's saying that this rule refers to a particular initiation, and the idea of leaving the personality life definitely behind is related to the initiation we're talking about. Do we understand what that is? I didn't get my Alice Bailey books up here yet. This is something that I don't want to live without while, you know, involved in a class. But the computer is a little slow, so we do what we can. Anyway, there is a phrase from Rays and the Initiations about the ancient authority. The ancient authority of what? And let's see if I can, here it is. Take a look on page 686. Each one of the initiations is epitomized and what it gives. Initiation one is the birth, and we were discussing it yesterday in some detail. Freedom from the control of the physical body and its appetites. Initiation 2, which we will discuss today, freedom from the control of the emotional nature and the selfish sensitivity of the lower self. So, in a way, freedom from many of the comfort responses. And now, here's what we're talking about, and here's the clue that we receive. Initiation 3, transfiguration, freedom from the ancient authority of the threefold personality. marking a climaxing moment in the history of all initiates. Freedom from the ancient authority of the threefold personality. And here we are. The personality life is definitely and finally left behind. There may still be self-interest, because we read over here that Initiation 4 finally frees us from all self-interest. So we can be beyond the personality and still have self-interest. In other words, we're interested in our individual self on the higher mental plane. And even that type of self-interest has to go. Freedom from all self-interest and the renouncing of the personal life in the interest of the larger whole. Even soul consciousness ceases to be of importance, and a more universal awareness, that's the triadal awareness, right? And one closer to the divine mind takes its place. So I would really recommend that when you want the epitome of the nine initiations, you turn to page 685 and 686, and there they are, like in one sentence, giving you the very essence of the description. So DK is assuming we are alert to the idea that we're leaving the personality life behind, and this tells us something about what initiation we're going through, and it's pretty clear it's the third initiation. We've been seeing it all along, but this reveals why it is so. And this means, of course, that if we do not have freedom from the personality, if we are not initiates of the third degree, we are still somehow struggling within that personality. And then, remember how I just mentioned Mars and the Moon, how the fires are burning within the lunar worlds, these lower frictional fires, fire by friction, ruling the 18 lower subplanes. You may remember that when we studied the initiations in esoteric astrology, this particular phrase came up to us. At the third initiation, the Moon, veiling a hidden planet, and Mars bring about a fearful conflict, but at the end, the man is released from personality control. So again, here's the confirmation of Mars and the Moon and the release from personality control. And until we are released from personality control, we're still in that realm of struggle, characterized by Mars' effect on the lunar vehicles. Then we move beyond it. Each of these rules contains within itself the clue to the particular initiation to which reference is being made. Well, okay, there are obviously, at least in terms of what we're studying, are not 14 initiations. So there has to be some doubling up somewhere. You know, and perhaps what we have is reference to five initiations and maybe seven. Even. But even if there were seven initiations to which we are referring, there would have to be two rules per initiation. And what I've seen is that some of these rules pertain to more than one initiation, or potentially so. Such as, let's say, rule number nine. Let the group know there are no other selves. Let the group know there is no color, only light. Then let darkness take the place of light, hiding all difference, blotting out all form. Then at the place of tension and at that darkest point, let the group see a point of clear, cold fire. And in the fire, right at its very heart, let the one initiator appear, whose star shone forth when first the door was passed. That particular rule has implications for the third initiation, but also for the fifth initiation. So DK says here, the rules are not placed in their right order, having sequential reference to the seven initiations. And yet, in a strange way, there is none of these rules that really begins at the very first initiation called the birth of the Christ within the heart. It's almost like when we talk about seven initiations, it begins at three and ends at nine. So there's a certain veiling going on here, but at least we should be, we try to be aware of which particular initiation may be indicated. And it seems quite clear for this one that it's the third. When we get to Rule 4 about letting all the 18 fires die down and the lesser lives return to the reservoir of life, it's the fourth initiation. When we get to Rule 11, it's also the fourth initiation. Let the group move the fire from the, let the group move the fire from the jewel in the lotus into the triad, and let them find the word that will carry out this task. And it says, even at the end, that when the brothers have reached the fourth great cycle of attainment, then will this work be done. So that's even obvious. So there are two rules, number 4 and number 11, which refer to the fourth initiation. And we could kind of go through and analyze all this, and then we would see maybe what is the proper order for these rules. But from a certain point of view, I believe Rule 1 is in the right place. And the interesting thing is, he says that once you reach Rule 8, only initiates can appreciate what's going on there. So it does seem that there is some kind of general sequence, the first seven rules and then the last seven rules. So I don't think this is going to be clarified immediately, but it's enough for us to know that every rule refers to a particular initiation. And then we can debate why we think it might be so and what particular hints we might be getting from the rule for the initiation that we face, even though it's on a lower turn of the spiral. These rules are not placed in the right order, having sequential reference to the seven initiations. The intuition of the aspirant must be invoked if he is to arrive at right knowledge. Now, when DK is calling us aspirants, he's not meaning someone who is not a disciple too. The aspiring disciple is what he's referring to. These rules cannot be approached by those who are simply waking up to the spiritual life, thinking it might be a good thing to pursue it, but mostly living a non-spiritual life, mostly not completely reoriented. So the word aspirant in this case means aspirant to one of the three initiations, and not just someone who has not yet quite stepped onto the probationary path where he's even willing to be tested. That's one of the key things about being a probationary disciple. You are willing to be tested, and you know you are undergoing tests. And when you're an aspirant, you're just going after something that looks interesting to you. It's a higher thing, it's interesting, but in terms of disciplining your life, you're not really there yet. That's more like when the fifth petal is sort of being organized and unfolding, but it's not fully unfolded. Once the fifth petal is fully unfolded, we are the initiate of the first degree. So there's a lot of human activity for modern man going on in the area of the fifth petal, all the way from the selfishly integrated personality up to the initiate of the first degree, and that's all occurring within that fifth petal process. I shall sometimes indicate the initiation involved, but not always, as it would profit not. I wonder why he says that. Why would it not be profitable for him to always indicate the initiation which is operative? What do you think? He could just lay it out for us and then we'd know, right? So why might it not be profitable? Yeah. That's it. It would prevent you from thinking, prevent you from exercising your own intuition, prevent you from really pondering and maybe arriving at the conclusion yourself. And when you can arrive at the conclusion yourself, it's a lot better than for somebody to just tell you. He basically says nobody listens to anyone else. Things are only meaningful to them when they arrive at them and confirm them for themselves. So, it's a, you know, we can be taught, but the teaching is more an indication of a direction we can go. The confirmation of the truth of what we are being taught has to be arrived at within ourselves intuitively. One day we just have to see it and know it, even though the teaching has been saying it all these years. So the inner confirmation is what we're after, and that requires the intuition. Even reasoning, though it helps, is not final. You know, you have to say, well, okay, all of my best reasoning points in this direction, and if my reasoning is correct, then this is correct. But that's not the same as intuitive confirmation, is it? You know, just really knowing something within yourself because you simply know it. Straight knowledge, in the words of Master Moria. The clue to the seventh initiation, put things in perspective here, really. The clue to the seventh initiation, which lies ahead for such high beings as the Christ, would be of no service to you at all. And yet, of course, he tells us some amazing things about the seventh initiation later in the book. Sometimes it seems that what he says he won't do, he does hundreds of pages later, thinking maybe better on it or having received permission to do so or realizing that maybe there would be some value about it. This tells us about the Christ, by the way. We are told that he has begun to take the seventh initiation. See, some of these higher initiations are very long processes. It seems that the Christ began to take the seventh initiation back in his previous appearance 2,000 years ago, and it will be more or less to the end of the Aquarian Age before he finishes that. Same with the Buddha, who, you know, took the sixth initiation at his enlightenment, so perhaps was beginning to take the seventh initiation back in his days appearing through the Prince Gautama. Sometimes initiations seem to be of short duration, like, for instance, the second, third, and fourth in one life, which he tells us is certainly possible, although I personally have not seen evidence of this, but he says it probably is the case. But even St. Paul, it seemed that it took him a number of years to complete the third initiation process. He may have been blinded by the light as he was on the road to Damascus, but later, D.K. says he was writing the so-called letters to the Hebrews, and in that process, he was reaching out towards the third initiation, and that was later. So it seems to cover a span of years, this initiatory process. This is what he calls stopping your steps before the door, arresting your steps before the door of initiation, and then proving yourself initiate. So, you know, it's not like an overnight thing. You know, you go to sleep, you're not an initiate, you wake up, you are. I mean, you know, becoming an initiate is a process of building certain responses and energies into your system. And then once they are built in, they can be confirmed by the initiator. It's the confirmation of what already is. That's what we call initiation. But the real job is the building in of the state. Not really. Would I have the time span? No. It seems that we know we are given some indications about short and long. For instance, after the first initiation, it seems to take a long time to build in the requirements for the second degree, because we have to overcome what is called the formidable astral nature. But then if the second, third, and fourth can be taken in one life, it tells us something about the possibilities, which would vary for each individual, of course. Maybe Krishnamurti was one of those who took the second, third, and fourth in one life, or who basically was seen as a second-degree initiate, and by the time his life was well progressed, he was into the fourth degree. Philip Lindsay, you know of him. He's a fine esoteric author, and he's written this astrological analysis of Krishnamurti. By the way, you should have come to the conference. He was giving away his books for free on the see. So all you have to do is spend $1,500 to come to conference, and you get a free book. Okay. but he was giving that out, and in that book, he analyzes the third and fourth initiations of Krishnamurti and the astrological accompaniments of them. So he begins as a second degree initiate and takes those other two, and it's all in the span of 20 years. That's short. And the fourth and fifth are usually taken in the same life as well, but then the expansion of time begins, and then we may be separated by hundreds of years, or even, as we see in the case of Christ, who is the most rapidly moving of all our present humanity, thousands of years between the sixth and the seventh initiation. So there's no precision in it. There's just an indication of what is short and what is long. And I wouldn't be surprised if once we get into things that, like we call the eighth and ninth initiation, if the time just keeps on expanding for those higher processes. And then when we start getting into the network connection difficulties, I hope not, then when we start expanding into the initiations that are taken by the planetary logos, then we're dealing with billions of years between. So the very shortest of the initiatory occurrences within a sequence seem to occur between the second and third and fourth, and maybe fourth and fifth. Right in there, it's a narrow passage. At the fourth initiation, you lose the causal body, or at least, okay, I'll let you go ahead. In other words, you don't have to die. This is the point. So, yeah. You have a spiritual triad, which is the true soul. The true ego is the spiritual triad. And so, even though you might go through this incredibly fiery experience, you will somehow retain your lower permanent atoms, or at least this is an interesting idea. I've never worked out the technicalities here. If the lower permanent atoms are burned up, what serves as the nucleus for your vehicles, which obviously keep on living? And I would say that the permanent atoms of the spiritual triad, which are considered the major permanent atoms, in some way send forth a substitute for that which has been destroyed. Or, well, I don't think there's any other way except to destroy the causal body and to destroy the permanent atoms. In other words, you cannot be an initiate of the fourth degree unless that happens. But since, usually, if you die, all of that quality rises into the permanent atoms of the spiritual triad, they are the ones that are responsible for creating the Maya Virupa. See, if a master creates a will-created body, he's got all that he needs within those higher permanent atoms, and by whatever process he uses, we call it Kriya Shakti or will-inspired imagination, he's able to send forth the power of the permanent atoms of the spiritual triad into the lower worlds and thus recreate the lower form. Now the question is, if at the fourth degree you're going through some conflagration, some fire, some destruction. What takes the place of the structure? And all I can think of at the moment is that somehow the permanent atoms of the spiritual triad support the vessel in the lower worlds until that incarnation is over. If you can take the fourth and fifth in the same life, as he sometimes says, then that has to be the way it is, because the soul body is no longer containing those lower permanent atoms. It doesn't even exist anymore. So the whole thing depends upon the power of the spiritual triad. Now, by what mechanism that occurs, I couldn't say. But to me, that's how it looks like it would have to occur. And we know that in the East, you can take the great renunciation and not die. In other words, in the West, we tend to get a little bit crucified around here, okay? But in the East, there have been many who have passed through that. They give up the world, they pass through that, and they maintain their outer form exactly so. So there must be some technicalities involved that I'm not aware of, but I know the spiritual triad holds and contains everything that was in the causal body, including the lower atomic triangle. The human being would have quite another kind of energy after that point. Absolutely. Maybe not, although even some of us, when someone passes through initiation, we say, rather unaware, well, there's been a real change in you. I noticed a real change. On our own level, we notice something. So maybe we would pick up something. See, what we really have to do is study the lives of fourth degree initiates who took that incarnation, in that incarnation, and did not pass on in the taking of it. Now, with Father Damien, I guess shortly he did pass on. He got leprosy and he died. So the exact timing of this is difficult to know. Does all of this fire happen when you die? The burning up, as it were? Is the death itself the entree into the burning? Or does the burning cause the death? These are technicalities. He said we would not know the details, okay? Yeah. The greater includes the lesser and not vice versa. You can't heal somebody higher, of higher initiatory status, okay? But you can support. Yes, okay? Yes. Yes. There must be some kind of parity with the one who wants to heal. Preferably maybe the healer stands a little above in knowledge and understanding, but at least parity. Yes. Yes. Yes, technicalities, yes. There are many, many issues here about this fourth initiation, which are obviously not totally solved for us. Yes, I have not been. Oh, well, okay. I'm being a little bit light in saying that. It's an incredible progress to take the second, third, and fourth initiation in the same life. I read a book about someone who apparently did this. And the book was very revelatory. It's The Life of Milarepa, the great yogi saint of Tibet. And it even looks like he went on to take mastership in the same life. There must have been some kind of incredible first ray driving him. But not that I would be in a position to assess this kind of progress in an average person. And true, if they took the fourth initiation, they might have just died and one doesn't know it. But in general, what I mean by what I said is that seeing that kind of incredible progress in a life is not a common experience. See, you know, most of the people we know are going along, right? They're, you know them at a certain age, and then 20 years later you know them, and then you know them 30 years later, and they seem to be, they're going along. They're more or less the same, you might say. But if you note dramatic, incredible progress, then perhaps, and not that you would be in a position necessarily to even evaluate that, but if it does impress you as such, then maybe something has happened. I'm just trying to, yes, good. Yes, there are many questions, and we cannot resolve all of these questions. All we can do is point ourselves in the right direction for pondering on them, thinking about them. And the details will be filled in later. But we do know two things. Taking the fourth initiation may end in death, in the taking of it, and the disappearance of the causal body and the permanent atoms may cause death, or it may not. We know those two possibilities. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, he's talking about the intuition necessarily being invoked in order to figure out which ones of these rules apply to which initiation. He says, don't think too much about the seventh initiation, though he does give us some very interesting information. He says, the clue to the initiation of transfiguration can be of importance to you, as it involves the personality, and many of you in the not-so-distant future, from the angle of the aeonial life cycle of the soul, will face that. Have I made something disappear? Will face that. So, he is telling us about the third degree, and even this, he's writing this in the explanation of a rule that relates to the third degree. The clue to the initiation of the transfiguration can be of importance as it involves the personality, and we are still in our personalities. The personality is not yet dominated. The ancient authority of the personality still exists for us. And many of you, and this is his sense of timing. It's kind of a joke in a way too, you know. You're in a hurry to take the initiation, he says. But it's going to happen pretty soon as the soul judges time. Now, what is that, a couple thousand years? I mean, we don't know how it is that the soul judges time. From the perspective of the aeonial life of the soul, which is thinking in great spans of eons, that is, rounds. One of the definitions of an eon is a round. So from the aeonial perspective of the life of the soul, you are facing that quite soon, relatively, even though from the perspective of the personality it may be centuries or even thousands of years. The secret of the third initiation, and this is really worth focusing on, even though, well, that's it. Okay, the secret of the third initiation is the demonstration, that's an important word in this definition, of complete freedom from the claims and demands of the personality. Now, the word demonstration means you have to manifest it. It's not enough to think that, oh, yes, I've achieved that. You actually have to show it to yourself. It has to be tested out. And aren't we lucky that the power of the sign Scorpio is still present with its unique testing potency at the time of the third degree? Because Scorpio will make sure that we do demonstrate whatever we say we have achieved. You know, Scorpio is a triple sign, so it makes sure that on every level of the personality, mental, emotional, physical, you demonstrate what it is you say you have achieved. So I think this is so important the demonstration of complete freedom from the claims and demands of the personality. Now he goes on to explain actually what that means, because the third degree is not perfection. Okay. It does not involve the achievement of a completely perfect expression of the spiritual life. Matter of fact, that word perfection is associated with a particular number. Do you know what number that is? If you remember your work from Cosmic Fire, page 188, where we're talking about the development of the extra senses, what number is the word perfection connected with? What do you think? As a matter of fact, one of the powers or cities is called perfection, and it is found on the fourth sublevel of the fifth plane. It's the higher correspondence to intuition. So perfection relates more to the number four, and whatever we achieve here under the number three is not perfect. It's not the perfect expression of the spiritual life, but it does indicate that the service of the initiate and his life demonstration, regarded in a broad and general way from the angle of the life tendency and of entire dedication to humanity, remains untouched by the limitations still existent of the lower personal self. In other words, there are limitations. There are imperfections in the lower personal self. But whereas so many people allow those limitations and imperfections to get in the way of their service and the way they live, the third degree initiate works right through them and does not allow those limitations to hamper the service and the life demonstration. And I think we have to look only as far as Alice Bailey, who obviously at a certain point in her life was a third degree initiate, to see that in action. There were all kinds of limitations that she was facing within herself and environmentally. And let's just say that the health issue was the main one, okay? That was a limitation of the lower personal self in the later part of her life, and she was really very seriously ill for many years. And you know how illness can stop most of us. We don't feel well, there's something aggravating going on within our system, and it immediately begins to affect how we live, and our service is compromised. We cannot give as much attention to, as much time to, our full energy to what we used to do in service, let us say. But not Alice Bailey. You know, even though she had leukemia for a long time, years and years and years, she worked right through that, and just kept powering away until the end, which looks like it was a fairly deliberate exit at the time of the completion of her work. It wasn't like she was snatched away unprepared, because she was in the hospital for a minor operation, as I understand it, and her time had just come, and her master came for her. And that was after living so many years in a compromised health condition, which she did not allow to touch her service. So that must have been a great act of will, right, to do that. And of course, she was endowed with a first-rate personality and a first-rate mind and Leo power, so she had that. But the astrology would not be enough. You'd need more. So there is not perfection here, but at least there is such a confirmed life tendency, such a dedication, such a sense of spiritual values, that the lower distractions are not allowed, even though they exist, and people say, oh, look, you know, you're that way and you're that way, those lower distractions are not allowed to stop the outpouring of the service of the soul. So, you know, because the rich young man is not perfect, so to speak. We know that. We know that there still may be self-interest in the third degree initiate. And the fourth degree solves that, freedom from all self-interest. The rich young man may not so much be attached to what he wants from the world as to his way of giving to the world. There can be an attachment there. Well, where you say to the higher up, you say, oh, I'm sorry, I want to serve the way I want to serve because I serve very well. And the higher up says, yes, you do serve very well, but we need you here more. And the whole situation needs you here more. So please give up your attachment to the way you want to serve. Follow me and serve the way we indicate you can serve. And that is a big discrimination right at that point. It indicates imperfection and the decision to be made. Now, you know, I'm thinking about the life of Albert Schweitzer, which I think is just classic for this kind of decision. Obviously, a third-degree initiate, a Capricorn, you know, so maybe that helps to confirm it because that's the sign most associated with the third degree. So he had everything in Europe, absolutely everything, but his conscience was indicating that he should go where people were really disadvantaged and had no medical help whatsoever in Lambarenia. I'm not sure where in Africa that is. It was in the Congo or wherever it is, but in those days, you know, it was really the backwater. So he's deciding within himself that that's what he has to do. And all the voices around him, are you crazy, Albert? Look at all you have. Look at all you're giving. You know, look at how you can make a difference in culture. You're the foremost expert in Bach of anyone. You know, you're a great philosopher. You're a wonderful theologian, blah, 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 blah. In other words, please stay in the world of the third degree where we are comfortable seeing you. And don't go off into the jungle, which makes us very uncomfortable. As we see you giving up all of this, it puts pressure on us to do the same, see? So we'd rather you just stay where you are. But then he made that decision. And although he took some of his culture with him, it was just an incredible change of life. So obviously he had made a decision which was taking him towards the fourth degree. Yes. Serve where we are best fitted, yes. You don't need to go out and help. Well, in the essence, I think, of what you're saying, you know, I'm really trying to hear it. We've got that noisy machine and all the rest of it, is that one, well, what D.K. says, do not serve in the capacity that another person who knows less than you could serve equally as well. He says, serve where you are most fitted to do it. In other words, offer the kind of service that for which you are best suited and which you can do the best, and do not take over someone else's service because you may feel inclined to. It's the old Hindu idea or Vedantic idea that better a man's own dharma. In other words, you might be able to do someone else's dharma better than they can, but it's their dharma, and your dharma is where you are. But I think it's a very individual matter. Because people like this who are third degree, like Father Damien and Albert Schweitzer, maybe on different rays, they could be quite expressive and useful in their particular area. But they see an unmet need, and no one else is meeting that need. and they evaluate which is the greater need. And then they do something which apparently, in the eyes of others, compromises their service. You mean you're just going to be a physician and do what an ordinary physician does out in the middle of the jungle when you could be doing all of this for society and culture? Well, as it turns out, Schweitzer could have just stayed put and say, okay, I'm very capable of serving right here, but as an example to the rest of humanity and an inspiration, what he did has inspired millions, and he had a far greater effect in doing what he did. So I'm saying it's very hard to decide these things by a general formula. Much depends on the individual and where they see the need and how they evaluate their circumstances. It was like that with Father Damien. He really didn't need to go sacrifice his life on Molokai Island. Large groups. Yeah, I believe you're correct. I believe they were serving at the planetary level, and they were serving a larger group, and they were serving those for whom they could not display all of their faculties. See, in other words, it looked as if they were compromised. They could not show the people they went to serve everything they knew and all the rest of it. They had to lower their method, what can I say? The skill set was a different set that they went to serve. Like, you know, Father Damien, he could have remained a theologian and, you know, he could have used his mind in a certain way. But instead, he's going out there building churches and the lepers in this colony, you know, they were losing their limbs, so he would make special adaptations in the church so they could even sit there. You know, it became totally manual almost, totally practical, away from the life of the mind. But what's really interesting about the fourth initiation is that it does involve the dense physical level so often. Because if you look at it, mind is one, emotions two, ether is three, and the dense physical level is four. So it's like somehow you have an appointment with matter. Even with Jesus and the people that he was serving and the whole idea of the matter and the cross and Capricorn and the dense level, it puts you right into the heart of humanity living on the lowest level. It's the sign of Taurus. Yes, Taurus is very strong there. Yes. Taurus is very strong at that initiation, which is very grounding in that respect. So, you know, none of us can put ourselves precisely into the consciousness of another and know all the decisions that lead to such a sacrifice. Nor can we make a generalization and say everybody has to do that. Because there, like you seem to be suggesting, there's a lot of do-gooder people that are running around, you know, leaving the place where they could serve, really, and trying to find other forms of service that are more conventional, you know. There's an old saying, bloom where you are planted, which has a lot to do with not running away from that which confronts you and where your service lies. And many people do. They, instead of realizing the service they could be offering immediately in their immediate situation, they're always looking elsewhere for real service, and they're missing the boat in that, of course. But there are these few examples who really do something unusual, and they set a high standard for many of us as we seek to understand the nature of sacrifice. People have such a horror of sacrifice that they try to explain it away and find 10 other definitions for it so that it's not sacrifice anymore. But even though all of those things may be correct, sacrifice does involve a temporary reduction of scope of the energies you might otherwise be expressing and receiving. Sanat Kumara is at his post, and what it means is there's all kinds of cosmic things he could be doing that he's not, because under Saturn, he's confined himself to that post. And Schweitzer did the same, and Father Damien did the same, and I'm sure Mother Teresa did the same. So there is a reduction of scope of expression in the interest of helping those who are within that smaller scope. Okay. All right. Anything else on that? Yes. Yes. Forerunner. Yes. Who is that who is waiting for that? Uh-huh. A forerunner is someone who sets an example, right? Master Kudumi says, a few drops do not make a monsoon, but they presage it. In other words, they tell it's coming, you know? So some of these people are setting a great example for us. But you were saying something about his astrological situation? Yeah. Yes, 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 yes. Yeah. In other words, perhaps it was not time for him to be initiated, so he was simply doing something indicative of the initiation. Well, this is difficult to say. The individual, we have to look at his chart when he did that. You know, first of all, we don't even know. We're not even given to know what are those specific astrological indicators without which the hierarchy will not initiate you. We know some things. We think we do, but we don't know exactly what they are looking for. What is, you know, look, all of us are part of the forerunning group, aren't we? We are all members of the forerunners. We are playing John the Baptist to the coming Christ, aren't we? Isn't that what we're doing? John the Baptist was a second degree initiate, born in Gemini, probably with a lot of Pisces, as he seemed to like water. And he was preparing the way for the fourth degree initiate to come, or even the sixth degree initiate to come. So this was a forerunner. In other words, he came before. When you look at the sky, it's like the little dog is the forerunner of the big dog. The star Procyon, which is called the little dog, gives us this John the Baptist in haste, in motion, spreading, telling the word, saying he's coming, and then comes Sirius, the Christ. So it's important for us to come to a determination of what our responsibility is while we are participating in the forerunning period. To a certain extent, the new group of world servers is like John the Baptist, announcing the coming of the greater energy. So you can see we have kind of a announcing responsibility. We have an indicating responsibility. We are basically saying, and they want us to say this, the hierarchy is coming. See, people don't expect this. They have some crazy ideas about Christ descending in the clouds and defeating evil for everybody. Nobody has to do any work and the good go to heaven and all that. So it's a lot of nonsense. And we have somehow to say, to give a clear vision of what the hierarchy is within our own limitations and say, and yes, the hierarchy is coming, and yes, the world teacher is coming, and it's up to you and to us to prepare his way. That's our job at this time. And that job is going to intensify during the next 13 years before the year 2025. Because it's going to be very important for humanity to believe in the message of the forerunners. Just the way John the Baptist baptized many before Jesus appeared, as it were, or began his mission, or the Christ began his own mission through Jesus. So we are in this era, and we have to open our mouths in a way, symbolically or otherwise, whether we write or talk or have some kind of connection with people where we let them know, we have to point to the future of the coming Christ, the coming second aspect, the coming hierarchy. That's our job. And of course, Schweitzer in his own way was doing that because he was living out the love energy. He was living out especially the love energy, the sacrifice energy. Okay. These are just relatively brief. He's not saying a whole lot about these last couple of sentences. Together let the band of brothers onward move out of the fire into the cold and towards the new attention. Of course, first of all, it has to be a band of brothers, doesn't it? It has to be a union of souls who all respond to the same vision, however individually they may express their talents. They respond to the same vision, and they are moving forward together to fulfill some objective, some shared objective. Now, everybody can ask, you know, if we are a group together, what is our shared objective? And are we united around it sufficiently to call us a band of brothers? Because I'll tell you what, a true brother is a monad. That's a monad. Brotherhood is on the monadic level. He explains that. Brotherhood is found on the monadic level first. That's its origin. And minimally, we're not just a bunch of people. We share soul communion and a vision of an aspect of the divine plan that we can together express. So before we can even think about moving like this, we have to know whether there is enough to hold us together as souls to really make us bonded brothers, as it were. Now, DK was trying to make that happen with his groups. He wanted that kind of brotherhood in these groups of nine people that he was getting together for telepathy, for glamour busting, for healing, for education, for politics. There were going to be all these groups of nine people that were going to be solid soul groups that would be seeds of service in every one of these areas. And these are called the 10 seed groups. So why am I saying this? I'm saying that some kind of important decision lies ahead for this group. This group here. For many reasons, there are circumstantial reasons, as we know. And there's also the period of the times, which is extremely pressing and very difficult. And I think that decisions are going to be forced upon this group, which will make it question, are we really a band of brothers? Are we heightening our point of tension or just kind of going along, which DK says you can do? Are we really moving forward using the first ray, progressively using the first ray, to go into a new dimension of group possibility? Now, you know, in a way, I'm not involved in helping you make your decision. I'm standing by and I'm here. But the decision is ultimately to be taken into consideration by you yourselves under these pressing circumstances. So what it really means is, does the group intensify its group life, or does it go along, or does it fall back? These are the questions with which you will be faced. And of course, none of us, or few of us, are very young. Maybe a few of us are a little younger, but not so many. So I predict that you will face this shortly. And, you know, consulting these rules, I think, is a very important inspiration to see what should be the correct decision. Okay, the next, together let the band of brothers onward move out of the fire into the cold. Here we go. We're going into the cold. Usually this is not considered such an appealing prospect. But since you live in the Nordic countries, you're used to it, right? It's kind of interesting, though, we expect of the Scandinavian countries up here in the north that they actually will see more clearly than a lot of places on the earth. They have a reputation for somehow understanding more clearly what's going on and not getting involved in all of the mess of the world, but helping to unmess the mess, you know, all of the peace work and the mediation work and, you know, things that are like from a superior position of understanding, not fighting when it's unnecessary, but trying to bring clarity so there can be peace. The Scandinavian countries have a good reputation for that. Into the cold. This means that the focus of the life is now in the realm of clear truth and pure reason. And the last few days, we have been dealing with that, haven't we? The clear cold light reveals what? Two things particularly? Maybe we remember. It's been several pages ago. Okay. Wait a second. Let me try it. Clear cold light. And cold it is. What does it? Yeah. Well, yeah, all the rules are the only formulas that as yet exist that lead to life more abundant. Or let's see. I'm trying to look here at the clear cold light, the burning ground, the clear cold light. There's two things particularly that the clear cold light is the light of pure reason, of infallible intuitive perception, and its unremitting, intensive, and revealing light constitutes a major test. And here are the two things the clear cold light reveals. Whatever page this is on, maybe it doesn't make any difference. Someone else can find the page. The omnipresence of God throughout nature. The clear cold light reveals the omnipresence of God throughout nature, and therefore God in all the personality life and the life of the initiate. Remember the scales? We talked about the scales. You see anew. The scales fall from the eyes, and then the dark night of the soul comes upon you because you realize how far you have been and how far all are from the central reality. It's an appalling revelation in the clear, cold light. And your personality will may clash with the divine will of the monad. So this omnipresence, the mystery of time and space and electricity are solved, and the great heresy of separateness comes to an end, that divinity is all this. This is the revelation, the first revelation of the clear, cold light. It's very powerfully stated here, very beautiful. And it's around page 39 and 40. The second revelation of the clear, cold light is the omniscience of the divine whole, the all-knowingness of the one, of the macrocosmic whole. Not only is the great being everywhere, the great being knows all, and you are part of that knowing, bringing to an end isolated experience and bringing you gradually into a state of isolated unity. A type of loneliness is over forever, and identification with divine purpose results. So, suspending the enlightened will of the soul in the interests of a still greater will, which is the will of the monad. So, the clear cold light, in short, reveals omnipresence and omniscience. Okay. Those are very big revelations. Very, very, very big revelations. So here we are. This means the focus of the life is now in the realm of clear truth and of pure reason. Now just think, if you could live your life and the group could live its life sustaining this ongoing rapport with truth, and in that state of inclusive reason, so all things were clear to us intuitively, intuitively clear to us, regardless of what craziness is going on around us and how people are reacting emotionally and how confused they are in their mind and how agitated they may be in their body. We see clearly and know what is the truth. So out of the fire, into the cold. That's a very special point of tension of a group like this. It's not the usual human way, you know, in these excitable times. The Christ is said to have something called, I still have to find the reference, but it's called calmness forever unperturbed. Calmness forever unperturbed, undisturbed. This is the consciousness of the Christ. So obviously he's always in a state of pure reason and clear truth. The vehicle of the initiate is being rapidly transferred out of the life of the initiate is being rapidly transferred out of the egoic center. This is happening even after the third degree. So it's already starting. The knowledge petals are disintegrating. In other words, his specific relationship to the world in terms of ordinary knowledge is no longer consuming much of his attention. He has a different type of relationship with the outer world. It's intuitively based. The soul vehicle, okay, the life of the initiate is being rapidly transferred out of the egoic center, the soul vehicle, onto the level of the Buddhic life or state of being. So his focus, his sense of being, is being rapidly transferred. He's understanding a huge amount. The synthesis petals are opening, and it's as if he's becoming more and more intuitive, more and more immersed in clear truth and reason, clear reason. He says, so the life of the initiate, note I do not say of consciousness. It's the soul vehicle onto the level of Buddhic life or state of being. DK is now going to try to discriminate here between consciousness and life. And what he's going to say is that on the triadal levels, we do not meet consciousness as we normally think of consciousness. We are entering a new realm of livingness, he's going to say. Note, he says Buddhic life or state of being, he does not call it a state of consciousness. This is formless, but preserves the fruitage of form experience. In other words, when your causal body sublimates into the cosmic ethers, the fruit of experience is preserved in this formless world. Otherwise, how could DK write about what he used to do when he was a human being? He's in that Buddhic consciousness. He's in the higher triad, and yet he remembers. So everything that you had is sublimated and still preserved. The fruit of experience is still there. It is being oriented towards a realized unity and identification with the life aspect of divinity, and this takes place after the third degree in a big way, and yet preserves its own recognized and achieved identity. In other words, you know who you have been, you know who you are. You don't suddenly have your identity vanish. That trail of experience that you have trodden is still yours. Because, you know, DK was writing, I remember something he said. He was talking to a Libran disciple who had fallen in love and left the work. So So I'm remember, you know, I remember that he said this. I'm trying to find where it was, but DK says to this man, who had all this Libra energy, "I am remembering my brother falling in love, the greatest of all glamours." This is what DK said to this man. Now, how does he remember? He's remembering back into his own life, you know, lifetimes ago. And yet he is focused in the spiritual triad. How does he remember? The only way he can remember is that whatever was in the permanent atoms in the atomic triangle stored up as memories have now all been sublimated into the permanent atoms of the triad, where you absolutely still remember. Okay? So this is interesting. It is being oriented towards a realized unity and identification with the life aspect of divinity, and yet preserves its own recognized and achieved identity. In other words, everything you've ever done is still remembered, if you wish. On this level of pure impersonality and of right orientation, the group stands obedient to the rule which governs this peculiar or particular stage of development. So, out of the fire into the cold, a level of pure impersonality and right orientation as far as the divine plan is concerned. What does it mean here that we have stepped into the cold and that it is a level of pure impersonality? What does that mean? What does that mean? A level of pure impersonality. Because look, if you're inside your causal body, it's not a level of pure impersonality, because it's the accumulation right in your face of everything you've ever done. You still are very much an individual. This is impersonal. What does it mean? That's it. Especially the whole. Especially the whole. Yes, exactly. The word, you know, so you're working for the whole, you're working for the group, and the word cold might represent kind of a hint of lacking the usual kind of, you said, love or desire. In other words, we know the old saying, that leaves me cold. You know, we sometimes say that. Aren't you interested in this? No, that leaves me cold. In other words, I have no interest. I have no desire to become involved with what you just suggested. It leaves me cold. Meaning I no longer, in the lower part of my being, respond to things the way I did before. Because in a way, those lower things have dropped away, and our response pattern has changed, and we are cold. In other words, we don't vibrate to the things we used to vibrate to. That's what it's all about. And it involves very much this idea of desire. Our desires have changed, and we don't get involved and attached with the things that used to hook us before. Dweller, yes. Yes. We touch the bottom. We know what it is. We've bottomed out. We've hit the bottom. and we no longer respond. You know, that's why they sometimes say that the greatest sinner makes the greatest saint. You know, having experienced all these things, you are unmoved by them anymore. You are cold to them. You leave them behind because they're part of your experience. They no longer attract. So this is a level of impersonality. The vibrations of the world of personality are recognized for what they are, and they no longer ensnare the consciousness. And isn't that what the Buddha was trying to do for people in how he taught? The Four Noble Truths? You know, he's basically saying, give up your desire for the phenomenal world, and suffering will end. and people are on fire in this world of samsara. They desire the impermanent and that which has lesser value and that which disappears. They desire all of these transient things, and they will always lose them. How can they ever be happy? So our desire nature changes profoundly in the cold. Now, you know, here's the question. Are we as a group, have we cultivated this ability to really live in the clear cold light and see all life as if from the clear cold light and no longer respond to the, he's been using this word quite a bit, enticements, to the enticements of the samsaric world, the enticements of the samsaric world. Because there's all kinds of things, you know, like when you go fishing, you have this fancy thing at the end of the line. It's got a hook in it, but the fish doesn't see that. It's called, in fishing language, it's called a lure. L-U-R-E, a lure. This is perfect parallel, you know, because a lure is something, oh, look at that shiny thing. See, isn't that pretty? Oh, it's very attractive. Now, we, you know, many of us have shiny things that we go after. It could be a person or a house or a car or a boat or, you know, it's shiny and it's got a hook in it. So you bite it and you say, I want that. And the next thing you know, you're hooked. And then you are trapped. And then the fisherman gets you. And the fisherman in this case is Mara, the Lord of Ignorance. He's got you now. So then we have to find a way to break out of that attachment that we ourselves have made because we have bitten on something that was less valuable than what we should have wanted. So we have to change. It's a Taurus situation. The Buddha, you know, there's high desires and low desires. There are things that are worth something and things that are not. And as long as we keep on chasing after the things that aren't worth anything, we're not going to be happy. But of course, it seems to take millions of years to adjust our sense of values. You know, at first, well, you know, there's this old story about how the American Indians sold Manhattan Island to the Dutch or whoever they were for $24 worth of shiny beads, something like that. But, you know, everybody says, well, weren't those Indians ridiculous? They gave up all of this for $24 of beads. And the Indians, see, that would be like of lesser value. But the Indians thought that the white men were stupid because in their mind, they said, how can anyone buy anything like this for anything? They're just giving us the beads. You can't sell land. You know, they had a completely different sense of values. Their sense of values was the correct one. They thought that there's no way to exchange this kind of stuff for that. So it was just foolishness on the part of these Dutch settlers to say that there could be an exchange. But meanwhile, in this era when Vulcan is coming into strength and Taurus and its light will be stronger, we have to know what it is worthwhile to pursue. And when you look at the modern capitalistic situation, and people chasing money the way they do, we obviously have a big problem with our sense of values. Meanwhile, nature is being compromised, people's health is being compromised, the beautiful spots of the world are being polluted. You know, all the things that are of real value are being they're being severely compromised. The things that allow us to live and enjoy and be inspired are all going down because of this pursuit of the symbol we call money. So we have a big Taurus problem to work out here, a big issue to work out. And only a clarified consciousness can work this out. It is difficult. And right now it's heading into a crisis, as we have been discussing, talking about bread, economics, the first initiation, the seventh ray, and so forth. Okay. Well, you know, did you have a question? Oh, I'm sorry, because I sometimes see your hand up, but I didn't know. Yes.
To observe what are their thoughts, basically. If we can do that within ourselves.
Yeah, and that's what the morning meditations are for, of course. See, agreed that we talk about it, you know, later, analyze it, but to actually get into it and to see it, to experience it, this is the objective, of course. So, you know, it's a two-prong, well, actually it's three. You know how it goes, meditation, study, and service. So the meditation brings you into direct contact with the state we're talking about. So hopefully we begin to enter that perception that we're talking about. But study, which is what we're doing now, allows you to look at it from every angle and to compare and to contrast, and it sort of clarifies the situation around the experience. So that's necessary too. And then, of course, the service aspect comes in, where we, having achieved this ourselves, are in the position to help others achieve it as well. I agree, it's got to be practical. At the same time, he's given this incredible wealth of thought, as well as many fine meditations. We just have to do it all. We have to meditate, study, and serve. It's the foundational triangle of all of our efforts. But meanwhile, you know, in a group like this, if we are intent, this is what we're going to go into next right after our break. If we are intent on increasing our point of tension, there will be a intensification of the clarity of our realization of truth. So it ends up being an act of will, an act of courage, a demand to advance forward, and we do. And along with that comes an enhancement of consciousness. So, you know, if you've ever dared to say, I want more and to do more and to do better and then move ahead, the consciousness to allow you to do that will also come with the daring act. So, you know, I've spoken about this, that as your body goes down, your consciousness must still keep going up. And that is such a challenge, and DK talks about this. You know, he talks about the challenge his disciples face when they've reached the high water mark of their physical strength and they are declining. And at the same time, they cannot let their consciousness decline. They might hold the gains in consciousness they've made, but the ideal thing is that their consciousness even continues to advance, even though the physical powers go down. So I'm looking at the whole esoteric community in the world, as I think I perceive it. And I'm seeing that many people who have been working for many years could appear tired. I know a lot of people that are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, or older, they've been working at it a long time. They could appear tired. They could justifiably seem tired. They could feel it. And now they have a choice. Do they just let the second ray impulse sort of fade out with them, or do they redouble their determination to live at a still higher point of tension? Of course, it will also help their physical nature as well, but it will certainly clarify their consciousness and make them more effective as servers. But this is an act of will. Of course, I'm talking to myself as I talk to you. You know, I'm precisely at that point in my life, almost 70, where I could, you know, just rest on a few laurels, or push ahead, which is the first ray way to do it. deeper, more intense, increase the point of tension out of the fire into the cold towards a newer tension. And I'm saying we as individuals face this, a group of this nature faces that. And when I look out in the world community of esotericists, they face that. They have to break through their comfort zones in many areas in order to be still more effective according to the demands of this rule. So, you know, being the typical Aries here, I'd like to urge them forward toward a newer point of tension if they dare to do it. And, you know, I'm kind of inspired to think in these terms when I read this kind of section from the old commentary. It will take more. You know, John the Baptist was not an easygoing guy. He had a big job to prepare the way for the coming of the Christ. And we are John the Baptist, and we are the new group of world servers, and we have a big job to prepare in an ignorant world. DK calls it the roaring tide of the world's ignorance. The roaring tide. As if it just drowns everything out. We have a big job here to prepare humanity to hear the hierarchical note. That's an exhortation, you know, and time will tell what we do. I've been, well, I'll let it go at that for the moment. It is just after 11, so we'll take our short break and then return to this nice phrase, towards a newer tension, which I think will be a point of enjoyment for all of us. Most of us. Okay.